California operating with a budget surplus. It is expensive in California. That's because of that free market that right wingers love. California's state income tax is progressive and it goes all the way up to 13%. If you pay 37% federally and 13% in California, that's 50%. And then you add property taxes, and properties are expensive in California. I'm not denying it's expensive. Part of the reason it's expensive is because there's not enough housing. Part of the reason it's expensive is because a lot of people want to live there. Homelessness, it's a major problem. Part of the reason that homelessness is a problem in California is the weather is good, and it's a safe place if you have no home, that if you're stuck outside, you're not going to freeze to death. And I don't think just about any part of California, you could go up in the hills to ski resorts. I don't think that's where the homeless people are. So there are criticisms of California, but this idea that there is a California exodus because of woke high tax California and it's failing and all these different things, it is simply not the case. I've never lived in California. I don't intend to. I have no personal horse in this race, but that is the reality. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com. I want to see you there, and we will be back. Well, the Republican Party is finally behaving rationally. Republicans are panicking that the now multiple arrests of failed former president, twice impeached, twice indicted Donald Trump may actually boomerang on them and be damaging big picture. There's an interesting article in The Hill by Alexander Bolton called "Republicans Fear Trump Legal Woes Will Boomerang on Them." Senate Republicans are worried that Trump's legal troubles will create a major headwind for Republican candidates in 2024. They say the battle between the Justice Department and Trump, who pleaded not guilty Tuesday, just as his unsubstantiated claims that the 2020 election was stolen became a prominent point of debate in last year's primaries. They worry Trump's dominance of the media spotlight will turn off swing voters, especially suburban women, and hurt their chances of taking back the Senate or protecting their small House majority. The article goes on to include a number of quotes from different Republicans. This is a logical reaction to what is going on. Now, there is a group of people that is choosing to narrowly focus only on the presidential race. And we will look at the polling in the presidential race a little bit later today. You could convince yourself and maybe others, if you look only at the presidential race, that it is quite binary and it doesn't have any trickle down effect what is happening with Donald Trump. Let me tell you what I mean by that. You could look at the Trump arrests and look at the Republican primary and say to yourself, listen, if Trump's arrests hurt Trump, someone else will win the primary. And then that person will face Joe Biden and they might win or they might lose. And it will have nothing to do with what is going on with Trump. In other words, the context is Trump's legal troubles will only affect who is the Republican nominee. And beyond that, it will not have any broader impact on the Republican Party. There are two problems with that relatively narrow focus. Problem number one is that indeed, if Trump is leading the Republican primary for several more months, but then he's arrested a third time and potentially arrested a fourth time, and then it becomes clear he can't really campaign because he's just going from courthouse to courthouse, and Ron DeSantis or someone else ends up winning the primary, the impact of that last minute collapse by Donald Trump doesn't end with the Republican primary. And there is the belief, and I believe it is a warranted belief, that if such a shakeup were to take place, it would weaken whoever is the eventual Republican nominee against Joe Biden. So that's one way in which thinking of the Trump arrests only as relevant to the Republican primary is wrong. But what Republicans are increasingly concerned about now is very serious, which is that this entire circus atmosphere and sideshow nature of what is going on, which also, by the way, includes some Republican candidates saying I would pardon Trump and others saying I wouldn't, and this just becoming the circus that it is, it may just be very bad for random Republican senators seeking re-election, for random members of the House of Representatives, some who are supporters of Trump and some who are not, that it will create a broader problem for any Republican that is running in November of 24, including simply that the Trump fiasco might reduce turnout and make some voters stay home who would otherwise vote to reelect some of these Republicans. It's too early to know whether that fear is backed by data, but intuitively, it makes a ton of.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It was the evening of October 1st, 1969, when I first smuggled several hundred pages of top-secret documents out of my safe at the Rand Corporation. The study contained 47 volumes, 7,000 pages. My plan was to Xerox the study and reveal the secret history of the Vietnam War to the American people.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg has died at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. His actions helped take down President Nixon, end the war in Vietnam, and lead to a major victory for press freedom. Henry Kissinger once called Ellsberg the most dangerous man in America. Today, we honor the life and legacy of Ellsberg in his own words.
If I were asked what regrets I have today, they would have to do with doing a job I was asked to do that I knew was wrong for the country, and I did it to the best of my ability. The war was carried on by people who acted like that.
We'll also look at how Dan Ellsberg became deeply involved in the anti-nuclear movement, which he detailed in his book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, and his concerns about Ukraine, China, and more. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has wrapped up a two-day trip to China. On Monday, he met with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing for half an hour, as both sides expressed a desire to stabilize relations to relieve soaring tensions between the world powers. Blinken also met with China's top foreign affairs official, Wang Yi, who urged the United States to stop hyping up the threat posed by China. Blinken is the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit China since 2018. This is Chinese President Xi Jinping.
State-to-state interaction should always be based on mutual respect and sincerity. I hope that through this visit, Mr. Secretary, you will make more positive contributions to stabilizing China's U.S. relations.
After the talks concluded, Antony Blinken spoke to reporters in Beijing.
In every meeting, I stress that direct engagement and sustained communication at senior levels is the best way to responsibly manage our differences and ensure that competition does not veer into conflict. And I heard the same from my Chinese counterparts. We both agree on the need to stabilize our relationship.
Six Palestinians were killed and another 90 injured during a massive Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank Monday. The dead included a 15-year-old Palestinian boy. At least one Palestinian journalist was shot and injured. During the raid, which was met by fierce resistance, Israel deployed U.S.-made Apache helicopter gunships for the first time inside the West Bank in nearly 20 years. The raid came a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government agreed to accelerate the process for approving new settlements in the West Bank, despite criticism from the United Nations, European Union, and the United States. More than 3,000 people have died in Sudan over the past 2 months since fighting began between rival military factions, this according to Sudan's health minister. A new 72-hour ceasefire began Sunday, a day after an airstrike in the capital Khartoum killed 17, including 5 children. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has expressed alarm about the deteriorating situation in West Darfur.
I am particularly concerned by reports of gender-based and sexual violence and by the ethnic dimension of the violence in Jenina. Targeted attacks against civilians based on their ethnic identities could amount to crimes against humanity.
In news from Uganda, around 42 people, including 37 students, were killed on Friday in an attack on a school located near Uganda's border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. The children and teens were between the ages of 13 and 18. Ugandan authorities have blamed the attack on the Allied Democratic Forces, a group with ties to the Islamic State based in the DRC. Six students are believed to have been abducted. A group of African leaders have met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow to push for an end to the Ukraine war. This is South African President Cyril Ramaphosa speaking in Moscow.
And we are here to communicate a very clear message that we would like this war to be ended.
The presidents of Senegal, Zambia, and Comoros, as well as top envoys from Egypt, Uganda, and the Republic of Congo, also took part in the talks. Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Ellsberg risked his life in prison by copying and then leaking 7,000 pages of top-secret documents outlining the obscured history of the U.S. war in Vietnam. The leak helped take down President Nixon and the war in Vietnam and led to a major victory for press freedom. Ellsberg would go on to become deeply involved in the anti-war and anti-nuclear movements. He also inspired a new generation of whistleblowers. We'll spend the hour remembering Dan Ellsberg in his own words after headlines. The Justice Department has accused the Minneapolis Police Department of disproportionately targeting Black and Native American people and frequently using excessive and unlawful use of force. The findings come in an investigation launched after the police murder of George Floyd in May 2020. Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke Friday.
The patterns and practices we observed made what happened to George Floyd possible. As one city leader told us, quote, these systemic issues didn't just occur on May 25th, 2020. There were instances like that that were being reported by the community long before that.
The Washington Post is reporting the Justice Department and the FBI waited more than a year before opening a probe into the role played by former President Donald Trump and his top associates in the January 6th insurrection and efforts to overturn the 2020 election. According to the Washington Post, a top deputy to FBI Director Christopher Wray quashed a plan early on to directly investigate Trump. Attorney General Merrick Garland supported the FBI's decision to focus on individuals who raided the Capitol instead of Trump and his associates. Meanwhile, Donald Trump appeared on Fox News Monday and talked about being arraigned on federal felony charges for mishandling classified documents. During the interview, Trump appeared to admit he did not comply with requests to return classified documents. He was interviewed by Fox's Brett Baer.
And in all fairness,
not just hand them over then?
Because I had boxes. I want to go through the boxes and get all my personal things out. I don't want to hand that over to NARA yet. And I was very busy, as you've sort of seen.
Yeah, but according to the indictment, you then tell this aide to move to other locations after telling your lawyers to say you'd fully complied with the subpoena when you hadn't.
But before I send boxes over, I have to take all of my things out. These boxes were interspersed with all sorts of things.
The Gun Violence Archive reports there were at least 19 mass shootings over the long weekend in the United States. At least 12 people died, more than 100 were injured across the country. In Willowbrook, Illinois, one person died, 22 were hurt in a shooting in the parking lot of a mall during a Juneteenth celebration. In Washington state, two people were shot dead. Three were injured at a campground near a music festival. Meanwhile, in St. Louis, Missouri, a 17-year-old was shot dead and another 11 teenagers were wounded at a party. In health news, the Associated Press reports 1.5 million people have been dropped from Medicaid in recent months as states begin to purge the rolls after the lifting of a pandemic-era rule on eligibility. The AP said most were dropped for not filling out paperwork. While the number of Medicaid recipients grew by over 20% during the pandemic, analysts estimate as many as 15 million people could lose their coverage over the next year. At least 170 people have died in northern India in a scorching heat wave overwhelming hospitals and morgues in the region. Power outages have left people with no running water, fans or air conditioners. Temperatures top 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Other regions of the world were also battered by heat waves in recent days. In Mexico, at least 8 people have died due to the extreme heat. Meanwhile, in the southern United States, at least 6 people were reported dead. Hundreds of thousands faced power outages as temperatures soared in Arizona, Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Mississippi. Some 30 million people were under excessive heat warnings as the heat also set off a series of tornadoes and storms. Today marks World Refugee Day. According to the United Nations, the number of refugees globally has reached over 35 million. That's 8 million more than a year ago. This comes as concern is growing that as many as 700 people trying to reach Europe may have drowned in last week's shipwreck in Greece. Authorities have recovered 80 bodies, but hundreds more are feared to have drowned. Many of the passengers were from Egypt, Syria, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Palestine. On Monday, Pakistan declared a day of mourning for Pakistanis who drowned. The Greek Coast Guard is facing backlash over its failure to help rescue passengers before the overcrowded fishing boat sank. And United Nations member states have adopted an historic treaty to protect marine life in the high seas as warming ocean temperatures and pollution threaten millions of species. The first ever agreement will create a special UN body charged with managing conservation of ocean life and establish marine protected areas. The treaty will also establish new rules assessing the environmental impacts of exploitative commercial activities on the ocean, including excessive fishing. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we spend the hour remembering Pentagon whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, who died Friday. Stay with us.
This country comes from the hearts of men, stood out from the crowd. And the time has come again for good men speaking out. There was a man behind closed doors who shared a secret truth. When he couldn't stand it anymore, he told everything he knew. And the people on the streets of the cities and towns all across this mighty land woke up from a dream when the word came down and began to understand what happens to the men with the power. And the man with the votes asleep, how the leaders could be telling us wrong, getting us in too deep. And the government felt betrayed, he broke the law, they say. I say that he upheld the law, written in the mind of man.
Written in the mind of man, song for Daniel Ellsberg by James Stein. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we spend the hour remembering the life and legacy of one of the world's most famous whistleblowers, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. He died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. His family said he died peacefully at his home in no pain and released a statement that, quote, Daniel was a seeker of truth and a patriotic truth teller, an anti-war activist, a beloved husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, a dear friend to many, and an inspiration to countless more, unquote. His son, Robert Ellsberg, shared how his father once said he would want his gravestone to say he became a part of the anti-Vietnam and anti-nuclear movement. In 1971, Dan Ellsberg, then a top military strategist working for the RAND Corporation, risked life in prison by secretly copying and then leaking 7,000 pages of top secret documents outlining the secret history of the U.S. war in Vietnam. The leak would end up helping to take down President Nixon, helping to end the war in Vietnam, and would lead to a major victory for press freedom. Henry Kissinger once called Ellsberg the most dangerous man in America. In 2009, a documentary of the same name told his story, which Dan Ellsberg narrated.
We are going to win.
Making national heroes out of those who steal secrets and publish them in the newspaper.
The hundreds of thousands we were killing was unjustified homicide, and I couldn't see the difference between that and murder. Murder had to be stopped.
This weekend, portions of a highly classified Pentagon document came to light for all the world to see, brought cries of outrage from Washington.
We got to get this son of a bitch.
Yes, Kennedy did send in troops in violation of the Geneva Accord. Johnson did start the buildup before he said he was going to.
These guys were lying through their teeth when they were talking to us. And here it is in black and white. There's no way of denying it.
The Times building is encircled by armed guards. We are printing tomorrow a top-secret government document.
A name has now come out as the possible source of the Times Pentagon documents. It is that of Daniel Ellsberg, the top policy analyst for the Defense and State Department.
I am prepared to answer to all the consequences of these decisions.
Henry Kissinger said that Daniel Ellsberg was the most dangerous man in America, and he had to be stopped.
The study was 47 volumes, 7,000 pages. It would take me months of Xeroxing.
We've dropped another 200,000 tons of bombs on Indochina. That's 10 Hiroshimas, one Hiroshima a week.
What has remained significant about the release of the Pentagon Papers is the decision by a public official to give priority to conscience as compared to career.
Daniel Ellsberg, whatever his intentions, gave aid and comfort to the enemy.
It was a crime from the start, carried out by four presidents, and now a fifth president was doing the same.
I'm not going to be part of this system of lying anymore.
It wasn't that we were on the wrong side. We were the wrong side.
That's the trailer for The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. The Nixon administration went to extraordinary lengths to silence and punish Ellsberg, including breaking into his psychiatrist's office. He was charged with violating the Espionage Act and faced over 100 years in prison. But the government's misconduct led to charges against him and Anthony Russo being dismissed. Dan Ellsberg said he'd been inspired to leak the documents by anti-war protesters. In fact, shortly before the Times first reported on the Pentagon Papers, Ellsberg took part in an anti-war protest in Washington, D.C. on May Day, 1971, as part of an affinity group with Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn. Over the past five decades, Dan Ellsberg remained a leading critic of U.S. militarism and U.S. nuclear weapons policy, as well as a prominent advocate for other whistleblowers. He wrote a memoir, Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, as well as the 2017 book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Today, we'll feature our interviews with Dan Ellsberg over the years about Vietnam, as well as Ukraine, China, and the threat of nuclear war. We begin with our most recent interview, which was April 27th, when Dan joined us from his home in Kensington, California. He had just been recently diagnosed with inoperable pancreatic cancer. Dan talked about he went from being a military analyst to a whistleblower and why he risked going to jail in an effort to end the Vietnam War.
Just yesterday was my wife's birthday, and we recalled that it was on April 17th, 1965. Not everyone can remember their first date like that, but that was the first SDS march against the war. And I was working in the Pentagon on the war, pursuing the war. She was going to interview people in a nationwide interview program she had, and she induced me to carry her Ewer heavy phonograph around with her tape recorder to interview people. And I marched up to the White House hoping carrying that recorder and hoping that I would not be in any picture of the Washington Post where my colleagues at the Pentagon would say, what? He's protesting the war on my one day off from the war during this. But the next day, I induced her to go to the cherry blossoms. And that was our first date. And we've been together ever since. So that was 57 years ago.
She really was the one who exposed you, is this right, to the anti-war movement by forcing you to carry her tape recorder. I mean, you were protesting right outside where you worked. You'd gone from Rand Corporation to the Pentagon.
Actually, it was right outside the Lincoln Memorial where we heard the speeches, and then we marched toward the White House and around the White House. I went back that evening to the Pentagon where I was working, having gotten her to promise to meet me the next day to go see the cherry blossoms. But I was very much in sympathy with what I was hearing on that stadium from I.F. Stone and others about the war. I felt at that time, as a Cold Warrior, that we were picking the wrong place to plant the flag on this one. This was a loser, and I was not enthusiastic about our getting involved in it. But that was my job, and I did it all too well. If I were asked what regrets I have today, they would have to do with doing a job I was asked to do that I knew was wrong for the country, and I did it to the best of my ability. The war was carried on by people who acted like that.
So I want to talk about what you decided to do and how seminal, how key the anti-war movement was to your thinking, not only meeting Patricia, but also seeing those war resistors, what were called draft dodgers, the draft resistors who said they'd rather be in prison than on the front lines in the war in Vietnam.
Well, many people, when the Pentagon Papers came out, a lot of people in the anti-war movement said, what's new about this? This is what we've been saying all along, which was true, which was that we had taken up a French neocolonial role, an imperial role, essentially, against the self-government of Vietnam, the sovereignty of Vietnam, and were doomed to suffer the same fate as the French, essentially, to keep killing people and losing people until we finally decided to go home and leave them ruling their own home. Well, that was known inside. The insiders who were pursuing the war and dropping the bombs, millions of tons of bombs, it came to be even later than this, knew the same thing and were doing it likewise. The question was what to do about it. All the people I was working with in the government by that time felt, everyone I could think of felt the war was hopeless, essentially. It was hopelessly stalemated, and there was no coming out. The words hope stalemate was taboo on the year I came back from Vietnam with hepatitis in 1967, after 2 years there. Lyndon Johnson had said no official is to use the word or hint at the word stalemate, and yet that's where it was. So the war continued. People did their jobs, and it went on as though that judgment had not been made. And eventually, what I really noticed was that there were people who felt much as I did and who were doing an awful lot more about it than I was doing. Namely, these were young people who, you didn't have to be an expert, you didn't have to have a PhD in international relations as somebody to see the truth about the war in Vietnam. As somebody said, you don't have to be an ichthyologist to know when a fish stinks. And these young people refused to go to be drafted when they could have gone to Canada or Sweden or gotten a deferment or joined the Air Force National Guard like George W. Bush, somehow gotten out of the fighting. But no, they chose to give it as strong a resistance as they could, nonviolently, in the footsteps of Rosa Parks in the South and Martin Luther King and others, and to say, no, this is wrong. You have to do this over our bodies. We will not participate in this because it's wrong. And I realized when I met young men like this, like Bob Eaton and Randy Keeler, who were on their way to prison simply to make the strongest message they could, which I believed as well, that the war was wrong. I realized I could think of doing what they did too, instead of just talking to insiders who felt as I did, but agreed there was just nothing you could do about it as long as the president wanted to carry on the war and his subordinates wanted to keep their jobs under the president, that they could, in fact, simply dissociate themselves from it and denounce the war openly. Very recently, we've seen very many comments that what the Pentagon Papers showed was that the war was not winnable. Actually, and that's why I gave the Pentagon Papers, and that was the effect of them. Actually, none of the people who went to prison to protest the war did so because they thought the war was not winnable. They did it because they thought the war was wrong. And that's something I think that people have not succeeded, have not been willing to recognize all these years, not just that the war, not just that the U.S. had taken on some noble measure that wasn't quite energetic enough to pursue or had other, or was easily distracted from or something like that, but that our country was, like so many other countries, capable of doing wrong and killing people without good reason. And in effect, an imperial kind of operation like that of the Japanese or the French after the Japanese or the Chinese before either of them. And those were the footsteps we were walking in. Well, I think to this day, the very idea that the U.S. is in some ways comparable to those empires, that it is an empire, is a taboo. And a very unfortunate one, because it makes it impossible to understand what's going on. Why are we doing this? What's happening? Why in the world are we in this position of ever, time after time, of fighting against the self-determination or the nationalism of other countries and taking on those murderous tasks as opposed to dealing with problems at home? I think of our country as a covert empire, where covert is a term of art in the Pentagon and the CIA in particular. And I worked with CIA people in Vietnam. My immediate boss there was a retired CIA general, General Edward Lansdale. And the word covert means plausibly deniable. It means not just secret. I'm doing something that I don't tell you about, but that I plant evidence suggests that I'm doing something different. And I'm not doing it. Somebody else is doing it. And the person above me is somebody else. Layer after layer to prevent the president from holding any accountability for what's happening. I think we not only feel we need and do be able to plausibly deny that we are an empire, that we run other people's governments, other people's police forces, that we decide who goes to jail and who gets shot in that country. And second, we deny the means we do to keep it a covert empire: assassinations, paramilitary, military buildups, and even overt wars in some cases, as in Vietnam or Iraq.
Dan, I wanted to go to that decision you made after giving your 13-year-old son, Robert, a copy of Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience. The civil disobedience you engaged in, this is a clip from that 2009 documentary, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Dan Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers.
It was the evening of October 1st, 1969, when I first smuggled several hundred pages of top-secret documents out of my safe at the Rand Corporation. The study contained 47 volumes, 7,000 pages. My plan was to Xerox the study and reveal the secret history of the Vietnam War to the American people.
The FBI was trying to find out who gave the New York Times a copy of the Pentagon's secret study.
Pow, like a thunderclap, you get the New York Times publishing the Pentagon Papers, and the country is panicking.
This is an attack on the whole integrity of government. And if whole file cabinets can be stolen and then made available to the press, you can't have orderly government anymore.
A name has now come out as the possible source of the Times Pentagon documents. It is that of Daniel Ellsberg, the top policy analyst for the Defense and State Department.
I think it is time in this country to quit making national heroes out of those who steal secrets and publish them in the newspaper.
First year of marriage, we're talking about him going to prison for the rest of his life.
Dr. Ellsberg, you have any concern about the possibility of going to prison for this?
We have a quick back. Wouldn't you go to prison to sell this war?
We felt so strongly that we were dealing with a national security crisis. Henry Kissinger said that Dr. Daniel Ellsberg was the most dangerous man in America, and he had to be stopped.
So that a clip from The Most Dangerous Man in America by Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith. I remember when we had you on, Dan, so many different times, beginning 27 years ago, you were one of our first guests on Democracy Now! But when this documentary came out, you and Patricia, your wife, came on the show with the directors. This goes to that point where you understood the stakes of what you were going to do. You brought your two little kids, 13-year-old Robert, 10-year-old Mary, to help you, not that they completely understood what you were doing, Xerox the 7,000 pages of the secret history of Vietnam, U.S. involvement in Vietnam.
That's right. I hadn't really meant to bring my daughter, but on the second occasion at all, she was only 10, but she had complained about being left in the car when I went up to do some last-minute Xeroxing with Robert. And once she was up there, she complained about being given nothing to do. So we gave her scissors. And when, by mistake, the police came to the door for the second time during this project, because the owner of the shop had not turned the key correctly, and it set off an alarm in the police station. So when the police arrived at the door, they found my son, who was 13 at that time, Robert, was running the Xerox machine, and I was collating on the floor various copies we were making, and Mary, who was 10, was cutting Top Secret off the tops and bottoms of the pages with the scissors, kind of a family project. So they saw how innocent it was, and they left. But my objective with my son in particular was to let him see that there were times when the best thing you could do, you really needed to say no to a government policy, even at the risk of prison. And I wanted him to see that I had not gone off my nut, as I would be described shortly, I was sure, that I was not acting as a traitor or fanatically or hysterically. I was just doing something in a businesslike way that I felt had to be done, even though it had a risk. I wanted to plant that idea in his life, and it took hold, as it did with my daughter. My son is the editor-in-chief of Orbis Books, the Catholic seminary liberation theology publishing house, and my daughter is head of Violence Against Women Project, a worldwide project at American University, both of them having been arrested at various times.
And you wanted them to know this because you recognized that this could be among the last time you were spending
with
them.
I would see them. Yes, I thought they'd otherwise just see me through heavy glass in a prison, and would have the way that Julian Assange has had to grow up with his young sons in his total security prison in Belmarsh for having facilitated truth-taking of the same kind that I've done. As a matter of fact, his is the first prosecution of a journalist for putting information out, and it will not be the last if he's successfully extradited over here. So he has a couple of children who've seen him literally only in prison, and better than not seeing him at all. That's certainly the case. But I revealed this year that I had the information from Julian Assange, essentially, that Chelsea Manning had given Assange, and which was later put out in the papers. I had that before the papers, before the newspapers had them, meaning that I was as indictable right now, as I'm talking to you, as any of the people who've been indicted by this Justice Department, because they're working with a law whose plain language is, on the one hand, unconstitutional from the point of view of the First Amendment, but read properly just says that anyone who reads or handles or stores a piece of paper that has been marked to be protected, marked classified by the government, is subject to imprisonment. That implies even to readers of the New York Times, and very definitely to journalists like Charlie Savage or the publishers or Julian himself. In other words, in that respect, we've gone backwards since that day. That was, after all, Mine was the first prosecution of anyone for telling the truth to the American people. And there have been several dozen since. And the first one of a journalist, actually, is, I think, just preceding the first one of a reader before we get there. So this law, the Espionage Act, very much needs to be repealed or rescinded in such a way that it does not serve like a British Official Secrets Act, which was a perfect law for an empire.
Daniel Ellsberg, Pentagon Papers whistleblower, speaking in April. He died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. When we come back, Dan Ellsberg talks about Ukraine, China, the threat of nuclear war, and more. Back in 30 seconds.
I want to thank you, Daniel Ellsberg, for all the notes that came from you. I said I want to thank you, Daniel Ellsberg, and Mary Lois Tackler, too.
Thank you, Daniel Ellsberg, by Blood Rock. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we remember Pentagon Papers whistleblower Dan Ellsberg, who died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. His actions helped take down President Nixon and the war in Vietnam, lead to a major victory for press freedom. Over the past half century, Ellsberg remained an anti-war and anti-nuclear activist who inspired a new generation of whistleblowers. We return now to our interview in April, when I asked Dan about the latest leak of Pentagon documents by 21-year-old Air National Guard member Jack Teixeira, who was indicted last week on 6 counts of willful retention and transmission of classified information. I asked Dan Ellsberg about what the leaks say about the war in Ukraine.
It's shown from the reaction to these leaks, the major leak being, once again, like the Pentagon Papers, that when a war appears to be stalemated, it may be stalemated from the inside just as well. That's what the Pentagon Papers showed, that there is no real prospect for progress and that killing people is on either side unjustified by any prospect of any humane result. Intelligence estimates have shown that a year from now, we will probably be in pretty much the same positions, a stalemate, and will not be willing to negotiate. What does that say about the people who are making our foreign policy? If that doesn't define a crisis, an emergency, what would? Well, yes, I suppose the prospect that we're about to lose within a month, and that's not what either is facing yet. I don't want to test how either side reacts if they're facing that. If the U.S. were to do what Biden is urged to do by many, which is to direct U.S. participation in the war, shooting Russians, as I say, for the first time since 1920, two years after the First World War ended, we were still shooting at Russians against Bolsheviks in 1920. Every Russian knows that. How many Americans know that? Any? So that they have that very much in their memory. When Biden is urged to send direct planes that Ukrainians can't yet operate, like the F-16, tanks that they cannot yet operate, the tendency to send Americans to operate those tanks and get them right away into business will be very strong along with that. I can only hope that Biden will be pressed by a large part of the public, pressed not to involve the U.S. directly in that war and to be pursuing negotiations, which it is currently absolutely eschewing, is rejecting the idea of negotiations. There's increasing information that 1 year ago, in early April 2022, Zelensky and Putin essentially had an agreement, within very close to an agreement, on a pre-war status quo, returning to a pre-war status quo in Crimea, in the Donbas, in relation to NATO and everything else, but that the U.S., And the British, Boris Johnson, went over that and said, we are not ready for that. We want the war to continue. We will not accept a negotiation. I would say that was a crime against humanity. And I say that with all seriousness. To the idea that we needed to see people killed on both sides in order, quote, to weaken the Russians, not for the benefit of the Ukrainians, but for an overall geopolitical strategy, was wicked. And however the war started, and I think with both incredibly bad judgment by Putin and aggression and atrocity, and on the other hand, provocation by the United States in the sense of policies that were consciously foreseen to increase the probability of a Russian crime of this sort, tells me that I think there were a lot of Americans who wanted this war, and they got exactly what they wanted, even better than they could have imagined. Huge arms sales to our allies, the U.S. again having an essential role in Europe with an indispensable enemy, an enemy that we could not run the world without. Russia, and Russia stepped into that role very willingly. To say that Russia had no choice but to do what they did do is fairly absurd. That's like saying you can provoke a person to shoot themselves in the foot, or in this case, to kneecap themselves. Putin had no choice but to kneecap himself and to give himself 800 more miles of adversarial border with Finland and to resuscitate NATO and get these arms sales and so forth. It's just absurd.
I also wanted to bring up China, because in 2021, you revealed that the government had drawn up plans to attack China with nuclear weapons over a crisis in the Taiwan Strait. Can you talk about the relevance of that today, and when you got that information?
Yes. I revealed that information right after The Economist magazine had a cover with Taiwan on the cover and a big bull mark on front of it, showing that it was, quote, the most dangerous place in the world at that point. And what was at stake was a U.S. intervention in the politics of China, namely supporting a secession movement, an independence movement by a portion of China regarded almost universally by Chinese as part of China, supporting it in a way which the Chinese were totally forecasting would lead to war, that they would not accept it any more than Lincoln accepted the secession of the Confederacy in this case. And we were pressing for that in a way that I have to say I can't entirely understand. People act as if they want war with China. How can that be? Selling them arms? Yes, I see that. But why they want to change the relation of Taiwan, which has been pretty much the same since 1979, right now, in a way that the Chinese guarantee us will lead to war, is inscrutable to me.
And you said that these nuclear war plans over the Taiwan Straits were made in 1958?
58, yeah, that's right. And by the way, there was almost a corresponding crisis earlier in 1954-55. So this was known as the second Taiwan crisis in the 50s. But the idea there was that we would initiate nuclear war if the Chinese successfully bombarded by artillery islands that were within artillery range, actually within visual range of the mainland, very easy. A couple of them are just a mile and a mile and a half off from the mainland. To keep those rocks from control by Beijing, we were prepared to send in U.S. planes that block that group blockade, send in U.S. ships to break that blockade. And if the artillery kept that off, or there was a danger of losing U.S. ships, we would hit Chinese targets as far away as Shanghai, which would certainly, in Eisenhower's terms, and who okayed this, If necessary to get through to those islands, we would initiate nuclear war. And he foresaw that as leading to Russian, the ally of China, attacks on Taiwan and on Okinawa, on Guam, even on Japan, which in turn guaranteed, in terms of our planning, all-out nuclear war, hitting every city in Russia and China, killing, as our estimates were at that time, 600 million people.
And their relevance today?
Over Taiwan. And that was what they—that's what they were planning to do then. The number of targets in China has not reduced since then. That was a time when any fighting with the Russians under Eisenhower, even if it started over Berlin, was guaranteed to include targeting China as a whole as well. That may have changed to some extent, but to a large extent, at various times, we've still continued to say, shouldn't we have a plan for war with Russia that doesn't include destroying China? To which the answer is, well, do you really want to destroy Russia and not China also? We'll be destroyed in the process. That would leave China ruling the world. In short, Russia and China have to be regarded as a joint target complex. Okay, this is insanity. This is a form of insanity, as a kind of myth and hoax that has taken over the public. It is as insane as QAnon or as the belief that Trump is the president currently of the United States. And yet the belief that we can do less bad by striking first than if we strike second is what confronts us in Ukraine, with a real possibility of a nuclear war coming out of this conflict. In other words, of most life on Earth, not all, most life on Earth being extinguished as a matter of the control of Crimea or the Donbas or Taiwan. That's insane.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg speaking on Democracy Now! In April, soon after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He died Friday at the age of 92. In December 2017, Dan Ellsberg joins us to talk about his book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. In 1961, Dan Ellsberg was a consultant for the Pentagon and the White House, where he drafted President John F. Kennedy's Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's plans for nuclear war. So you made copies of top secret reports for plans about nuclear war years before you copied the Pentagon Papers and released them to the press?
Essentially my notes and sometimes verbatim excerpts, not the entire plans themselves, but on plans that were then unknown to the president, to begin with, to President Kennedy. I briefed his aide, McGeorge Bundy, in his first month in office on the nature of the plans and some of the other problems, like the delegation of authority to theater commanders for nuclear war by President Eisenhower, which was fairly shocking to McGeorge Bundy, even though Kennedy chose to renew that delegation, as other presidents have. But I was given the job of improving the Eisenhower plans, which was not a very high bar, actually, at that time, because they were, on their face, the worst plans in the history of warfare. A number of people who saw them, but very few civilians ever got a look at them. In fact, the Joint Chiefs couldn't really get the targets out of General LeMay at the Strategic Air Command. And there was a good reason for that. They were insane. They called for first strike plans, which was by order of President Eisenhower. He didn't want any plan for a limited war of any kind with the Soviet Union under any circumstances, because that would enable the Army to ask for enormous numbers of divisions or even tactical nuclear weapons to deal with the Soviets. So he required that the only plan for fighting Soviets under any circumstances, such as an encounter in the Berlin corridor, the axis to West Berlin, or over Iran, which was already a flashpoint at that point, or Yugoslavia, if they'd gone in. However the war started, with an uprising in East Germany, for example, however it got started, Eisenhower's directed plan was for all-out war in a first initiation of nuclear war, assuming the Soviets had not used nuclear weapons. And that plan called, in our first strike, for hitting every city, actually every town, over 25,000 in the USSR, and every city in China. A war with Russia would inevitably involve immediate attacks on every city in China. In the course of doing this, There were no reserves. Everything was to be thrown as soon as it was available. It was a vast trucking operation of thermonuclear weapons over to the USSR, but not only the USSR. The captive nations, the East Europe satellites in the Warsaw Pact, were to be hit in their air defenses, which were all near cities or transport points, their communications of any kind. So they were to be annihilated as well. I couldn't believe when I saw these that the Joint Chiefs actually had ever calculated how many people they would actually kill in this course. In fact, colonels who were friends of mine in the air staff told me they'd never seen an actual figure for the total casualties. We had exact figures of the number of targets and how many planes would be needed and every sort of thing, many calculations, but not victims. So I drafted a question which the aide to McGeorge Bundy, Bob Comer, sent to the Joint Chiefs in the name of the president. And the question was, in the event of your carrying out your general nuclear war plans, which were first strike plans, how many will die? First, I asked, in the USSR and China alone. In the thought that, by the way, they'd be embarrassed to discover, to say, we have to have more time. We've never really calculated that. I was wrong, and my friends were wrong in the Air Force. They came back with an answer very quickly. 325 million people in the USSR and China alone. Well, then I asked, all right, how many altogether? And a few days later, 100 million in East Europe, the captive nations, another 100 million in West Europe, our allies, from our own strikes, by fallout, depending on which way the wind blew. And however the wind blew, a third 100 million in adjoining countries, neutral countries like Austria and Finland, or Afghanistan then, Japan, northern India, and so forth, a total of 600 million people. That was a time, by the way, when the population of the world was 3 billion. And that was an underestimate of their casualties, 100 Holocausts. It was very clear that they hadn't included, I hadn't asked actually, what would Russian retaliation be against us and against West Europe. They were thought at that time, wrongly, to have hundreds of weapons against the U.S., but they did have hundreds of weapons against West Europe. No question West Europe would go under any circumstances. If we were defending West Europe, Germany, for example, we were planning to destroy the continent in order to save it. 600 million, that was 100 Holocausts. And when I held the piece of paper in my hand that had that figure, that they'd sent out unembarrassedly, you know, proudly to the president, here's what we will do, I thought, this is the most evil plan that has ever existed. It's insane. The weapons, the machinery that will carry this out, this is no hypothetical plan like Hermann Kahn might have conceived at the doomsday machine that he thought up at the Rand Corporation, as my colleague. This was an actual war plan for how we would use the existing weapons, many of which I'd seen already that time.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Dan Ellsberg speaking on Democracy Now! In December 2017 about his book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. 2 years later, in 2019, I spoke to Daniel Ellsberg a day after the Justice Department charged WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange with 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act for publishing U.S. military and diplomatic documents exposing U.S. war crimes. Assange, who's locked up in the Belmarsh prison in London, faces up to 175 years in prison if extradited to the U.S. and convicted here.
Yesterday is a day that will live in the history of journalism, of law in this country, and of civil liberties in this country, because it was a direct attack on the First Amendment, an unprecedented one. There hasn't actually been such a significant attack on the freedom of the press, the First Amendment, which is the bedrock of our republic, really, our form of government, since my case in 1971, 48 years ago. But this is, I was indicted as a source. And I warned newsmen then that that would not be the last indictment of a source if I were convicted. Well, I wasn't convicted. The charges were dropped on governmental misconduct, and it was another 10 years before anybody else faced that charge under the Espionage Act again, Samuel Loring Morrison.
And it was not until President Obama that 9 cases were brought, as I'd been warning for so long. But my warning really was that it wasn't going to stop there. Almost inevitably, there would be a stronger attack directly on the foundations of journalism against editors, publishers, and journalists themselves. And we've now seen that as of yesterday. That's a new front in President Trump's war on the free press, which he regards as the enemy of the people.
And the Trump administration saying Julian Assange is not a publisher, is not a journalist, that's why he is not protected by the First Amendment.
In the face of this new indictment, which—and let me correct something that's been said just a little wrong by everybody so far. He doesn't just face 170 years. That's for the 17 counts on the Espionage Act, each worth 10. Plus, he's still facing the 5-year conspiracy charge that he started out with a few weeks ago. I was sure that the administration did not want to keep Julian Assange in jail just for 5 years. So I've been expecting these Espionage Act charges. I really expected them later after he was extradited, because adding them now makes it a little more complicated for Britain to extradite him now, as I understand it. They're not supposed to extradite for political offenses or for political motives. And this is obviously for both political motives and political offenses. So from Julian Assange's point of view, it makes extradition a little more difficult. Why then did they bring it right now? Well, coming back to the case, by the way, that I faced only 11 Felony Act charges, each worth 10 years in prison, plus a conspiracy charge worth 5. So I was facing exactly 115 years in prison. He's facing exactly 175. Now, that's not a difference that makes any difference. In both cases, it's a question of a life sentence. I think that the reason they brought these charges so soon, because they had until June 12th, was to lay out, the necessity to lay out for extradition all the charges they planned to bring. And I don't assume these are the last ones. They've got a couple of weeks left to string up some new charges. They started out with a charge that made Julian look something other than a normal journalist. The help to hacking a password sounded like something that even in the digital age, perhaps most journalists wouldn't do. And that would hope to separate him from the support of other journalists. In this case, when they had to lay out their larger charge, this is straight journalism. They mentioned, for instance, that he solicited investigative material. He solicited classified information terribly. He didn't just passively receive it over the transom. I can't count the number of times I've been solicited for classified information, starting with the Pentagon Papers, but long after that. And that's by every member of the responsible press that I dealt with, the Times, the Post, AP, you name it. That's journalism. So what they have done is recognizable, I think, this time to all journalists that they are in the crosshairs of this one. They may not have known enough about digital performance to help a source conceal her identity by using new passwords, as Julian was charged with. They may not be able to do that, but every one of them has eagerly received classified information and solicited it.
We end our show with Daniel Ellsberg in his own words, May 18th, 2018, when I spoke to him at a Right Livelihood Laureate gathering at University of California, Santa Cruz. I asked him what message he had for government insiders who are considering becoming whistleblowers.
My message to them is, don't do what I did. Don't wait till the bombs are actually falling or thousands more have died before you do what I wish I'd done years earlier in 64 or even 61 on the nuclear issue, and that is reveal the truth that you know, the dangerous truths that are being withheld by the government at whatever cost to yourself, whatever risk that may take. Consider doing that because a war's worth of lives may be at stake. Or in the case of the two existential crises I'm talking about, the future of humanity is at stake. So many graduating classes, I think, have been talked, have been told year after year for half a century that they face a crossroads or that much depends on what they do. That's no exaggeration right now. It's this generation, not the next one,
that the people living right now that have to change these problems fast. And I think truth-telling is crucial to mobilize that.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Our deepest condolences to his family, his wife Patricia, his children Robert, Mary, and Michael, his grandchildren, and his great-granddaughter. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for joining us.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.